Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik Palmgren and this is Internet Talk Radio recorded from the west coast of Sweden. Wherever you are, you can find us from around the world through our website redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E creations.com. We are here doing radio on Thursdays and Sundays. Our website also features news updated every day with interesting, thought-provoking and important news stories from around the world and beyond. Links to research, videos and other material. I also want to mention that you shouldn't forget to take advantage of our member section. We have our entire radio archive available for you there, going back over 2 years now. We also have extended interviews with many of our guests, video interviews, a members forum, articles, our short film, and we have much more of that in the pipeline. You can find all the information again on our website, redicecreations.com. Today we are going to talk about one of the most interesting subjects there is, human origins. Where did we come from? How did we get here? And why are we here? We have Lloyd Pye back with us on the program today to discuss his research on everything from the hominids to the intervention theory, the genetic engineering of the human species. And we're going to also hear if there are some other news or updates on the Star Child skull. I'd recommend that you go back into our archive and into our member section and listen to our first program that we did with Lloyd to get the proper background story as we go into some of these topics. The website is lloydpye.com, where you can find much more information about his research material and links also to where you can get copies of his books. Everything You Know Is Wrong and The Star Child Skull. These are available through Amazon.com and also BellLapBooks.com. Do take a look at that. All right, welcome back to the program, Lloyd Pye. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Hendrik, and I'd like to, if I could, correct a couple of things that you said that are important for people. If they go to the website, Lloyd Pye, LLOYDPYE.com, you need to spell it, because if you don't, they'll get the spelling of my last name wrong. It's P-Y-E instead of I. But the book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, is currently not available anywhere, actually, except through a woman named Belinda McKenzie in London, who has some copies left over from a speaking engagement that I did in England a couple of years ago. The book went out of print last year, and it's now selling for, used copies are selling on Amazon for like $100 US, which is just ridiculous, and I urge nobody to buy that. Get one from Belinda if you really want a copy now. But I'm also planning to bring out an update. That's why it's went out of print. I'm trying to update Everything You Know Is Wrong with new material that's accumulated over the 10 years since it's been published. It's still a very good book. It has a lot of very good information about hominoids, Bigfoot, the Abominable Snowman, and the work of Zechariah Sitchin and others. So it's, you know, 80% of it is still solid, but I'm changing and I'm updating and I'm adding more to it. So I would advise people, unless they really are desperate to know the information right away, to wait for the update, which will be the latter part of this year, early part of next year, somewhere in there it should be available. So I didn't want anybody to misunderstand that they could just go and get a copy of it, because it, right now it's extremely hard to get copies of that book.
Do you know if there's a simple way to reach Belinda in London
to
get a copy?
Yes, there is. B. dot McKenzie, B. dot McKenzie at btinternet.com. That's B.McKenzie at btinternet.com. And she has them reasonably priced. All you have to do is pay for the shipping, well, for the book, of course, and the shipping from London, wherever you are, if you're ordering a copy of it.
Brilliant. I will have
the other one should be available, I would say, within 6 months, maybe a little more. I've been saying that for a year now, trying to get to it, but it's hard to get back. I've been working on fiction and doing other things, the work that I have to do to make a living.
Right.
But that's my intention, and I certainly hope to get it done as soon as possible. But if you just have to have it now, and like I say, there's about 80% of it is still very solid, good stuff that isn't going to change, because it's very historic in nature. It just deals with things from the past that just don't change.
Right.
But what has changed is part name tells it. And as you know, there are always new fossils being discovered and being added to that list, the hobbits being the most famous of recent vintage that were added. So the hobbits will be discussed in the book, and other new things within the past 10 years will be added as well.
Brilliant. For all those who didn't catch the email address, I'm going to have that up on this information page to this in relation to this radio show. So just click on that link and get in contact with Belinda in London.
Well, and understand, too, people need to understand, this is really one of the best, I mean, even though I wrote it, it's still considered by many people one of the best books in the field for explaining the issue of human origins and hominoids, Bigfoot, like that, and the work of Sitchin and what that means relative to that. Just human origins in general is probably the best book out there, and that's why it's sold, you know, over 30,000 copies now, but that's why it's going for so much money in the used book market, because they're just in demand. But again, please don't pay those ridiculous prices. That's just absurd. I don't know how they get away with that. But get them from Belinda until she runs out, and just, you know, wait for the update, and it'll be worth your wait or worth your time and trouble to get one from Belinda.
And you mentioned, of course, the hobbits or the, I think they were called the Florensis something, wasn't that right? This hobbit species?
Florensis. Florensis,
right.
Homo florensis, right. And they're just trying to say that that's I mean, everybody pretty much knows the argument that's been going back and forth. They don't look human at all, except that they stand upright. So they have to be qualified as humans of some kind. And inasmuch as they, because they were found and were living as little as 18,000 years ago and maybe less, scientists are really stuck, because they don't want a human being of that recent vintage. So they're trying to say that it's a deformed dwarf, it's a midget, you know, they're trying to work around it any way they can. But they know what they're looking at. They're looking at something that's the same size pretty much as Lucy, the famous Lucy of 3.2 million years ago. And there's not a lot difference in the hobbits, except they're a lot more modern looking in the head. They have a rounder brain case, but they still have no forehead. They have the large, heavy brow ridges. They have the big round night vision eyes. They have the prognathous mouth. They have no chin. They are apes. They are upright walking apes. The hobbits are, but they have to call them as some kind of either deformed human or some kind of primitive human that dwarfed down by being isolated on an island. They're doing everything to avoid calling them what they are, which is upright walking apes, because that means that it opens up the door to hominoids, to having to discuss hominoids realistically, because that area, Indonesia, is really the number one place in the world where the dwarf kind of hominoid is found. There are four main kinds. There's the giant kind, which is the Bigfoot Sasquatch kind. There's the abominable snowman kind, which is basically a man-sized 5 to 7 feet tall, but it's a very primitive type, the most ape-like of the upright walking hominoids. Then there's a man-sized 5 to 7 feet tall, more human-like one called the Almas, which dominate in Russia and places like that. And then there is the Agagwis, the small ones, the Dwindies, the small ones, and they're known around the equator pretty much and in the jungles of the world, Indonesia being the hot spot. So it's clear to anybody that knows the background of hominoids and the history of hominoids and about the four types and the four sizes, a blind person can see that the hobbit is just one, it's the skeleton of one of those hominoids from only 15 to 18,000 years ago. They're living today, just like the people there say, yeah, they're living up in the mountains right now today, these little creatures, or these little hair-covered creatures. But science, mainstream science, is really stuck with trying to fend this kind of knowledge off as much as they can for as long as they can, because while they know it's true, the evidence is overwhelming to anybody that studies this sort of stuff. If I know it, they know it, and it's clearly true, but it means so many bad things to them to acknowledge it, because it upsets their whole apple cart of human evolution. And that's the thing they don't want to lose, is evolution, because when they lose evolution, they're going to lose everything relative to their arguments with creationists, you know, the creationists and the intelligent designers. There's a real ideological war going on in academic circles, because mainstream science does not want to lose its grip, in the same way that religion didn't want to lose its grip when Darwin came along. And religion fought very hard to hang on for a very long time, but eventually science won out. But now science is going to be proved wrong in the same way that religion was proved wrong.
Right.
And religion is going to gain a lot of ground against science. Where science hurts themselves is they just don't care about the truth anymore. They just want to win against the creationists, and the truth just does not matter anymore. The truth mattered at one time, but now it's just defending the faith.
Right, right.
Mainstream science has become a religion, and they have to defend their faith against the other faith of the creationists.
Well, exactly, and that's the sad part about this. They're not willing to actually go where the evidence points at this point. And as you say, they're just defending their view. And of course, there's so much more behind why that is the reason politically, you know, even for the sake of, keeping mankind, if you will, not in bondage, perhaps, but in that kind of mindset that everything is okay. You know, we come here through evolution. If we were to talk about things like the intervention theory and that there is someone else around in the universe, right, going around and doing these things, that would as you say, upset the apple cart.
Exactly. It would just be a tremendous loss for them in terms of status and faith and power and control. People, you know, if they're that wrong about something so fundamental, what can they be right about? And in fact, that's why I call my book Everything You Know Is Wrong. The more I look, and the more anybody looks around at what we think we know, we don't know anything that's going to really hold up in our era right now. We know as much for real, for sure, that's absolute and going to stay the same, you know, forever, as much as people 300 years ago knew when they said that, well, the Earth is the center of everything and everything revolves around the Earth. And then there were those that believed the Earth was flat. And, you know, we look back on them now and we think, you know, how absolutely stupidly asinine is that?
Yeah.
And yet 300 years from now, maybe even 100 years from now, people are going to look back on us and say, God, how could they have been so stupid? That's really how it's going to be. Everything just about that we hang our hats on and think, well, we know at least this much, you know, like the Big Bang theory of cosmology and evolution and, you know, the big linchpins of science, they're all wrong. And it's going to be over time shown that that's the case. It'll be just a very different world then whenever we acknowledge that. But it's just the story of science. If you study the history of it, the story of science is this. It's just one long series of corrected mistakes.
Yeah.
They just do nothing but make mistakes that they have to correct. That's how science progresses to the extent that it has. But it's all built on mistakes, making more mistakes, and then making more mistakes to correct those mistakes. But they're all mistakes because they start out with flawed precepts, and it just keeps them in basic ignorance. Starting out, for example, with the idea that gravity holds everything together in the universe. They do that because that's what Newton said, and then Einstein built on Newton. But Newton was wrong. It isn't gravity, it's electricity. It's anybody that wants to check that out, just go to look up the electric universe theory, and find out there's a whole other alternative theory out there that makes so much more sense than gravity does, but science will not accept it because they don't want to give up Newton and they don't want to give up Einstein.
That's right, and what we need to do is learn from our mistakes, because as you say, the mistakes I think are important to make, and they are the initiatory step, if you will, to get in the right direction, but we need to learn from our mistakes. Right now, we're kind of had this idea that we're on top of the world. We know what's going on, and people are too proud to admit that they've been wrong. And I think that ultimately will be the big kind of downfall, if you will, of much of the, you know, academic world. And I hope to, you know, to some regard that we can, you know, highlight this information and bring it out there so people for themselves can look at it and look at the evidence and say, my God, there's something totally wrong here and something totally missing in the theories that they're laying at us at this moment.
Well, I think science makes the mistake of thinking, you know, kind of what you said, that there's going to be some kind of downfall when they're proved wrong. But there never is. They're proved wrong on a very regular basis, and there's no downfall. Everybody just adjusts and they move forward. For example, one of the things I talk about in Everything You Know Is Wrong, classic example, in 1915, and this is classic because this is the way it is. Big change never, ever comes from within the scientific community. It always comes from people who are considered outsiders, who are considered rebels, who are considered not having the sense or the knowledge to make the breakthrough. And this was Einstein, by the way, when he was a young patent clerk. He wasn't part of the system. He just overwhelmed the system with something that was on the money.
Right.
And Darwin kind of was the same way. Outsiders, not teaching, not an accredited teacher. It always comes from people who are just doing it on their own, and they're not looking at the way things were taught to them. They're looking at the way things are. And in 1915, a weatherman named Alfred Wegener, a man who studied weather patterns, but he was also a traveler and an adventurer, and he's the one who came up with the idea that North and South America had at one time been welded to Europe and Africa in one big giant continent, because it was really clear, the evidence was clear in a number of ways. They had similar animals on both sides, the mountains, the Atlas Mountains and the Appalachian Mountains of America, and the Atlas Mountains of Europe, they looked the same. There were freshwater fish in the rivers on both sides. How could freshwater fish cross the oceans? You know, there were monkeys, similar monkeys on both sides. There was all this evidence that Wegener pulled together, but he was an outsider, and he was saying that at a time when science and religion and everybody else was just reeling from absorbing Darwin, then he came along with something saying that the world itself was not stable, was not secure. And everybody acknowledged that volcanoes happened and that earthquakes happened and all that, but to say that the continents moved around the globe, that was just insane in 1915. Hmm. And it took 50 years until 65 when it was proven in a way that it couldn't be denied anymore. And what happens is it usually requires about 50 years because two full generations of scientists have to die, have to literally die, because they will not give in. They will not give in to the point, no matter how right it is. And so it takes time. If they can defeat it initially, like they couldn't defeat Darwin, they couldn't defeat Einstein, but they could defeat Wegener, and they did. And so then it took, he was just buried and forgotten. And 50 years later, everybody realized, oh yeah, that guy was right, you know. And that is more the pattern of science. Resistance, 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 even though it's clearly true, because they're just not ready to deal with it, and they will, because that isn't what they're taught, it's not what they believe. Two generations die out, and the third generation is comfortable enough with it to accept it. That is the pattern of scientific progress over time.
I have this great quote from Max Planck, actually said, "A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die, and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it."
That's exactly what I'm saying in a very short way. Very short way.
Yeah.
Exactly the truth. That's a great quote.
Yeah.
I'm amazed you could pull that one off the top of your head.
I searched for it. I remember putting it on the website, so I have it right there.
Ah, great.
But
it is. It's a perfect quote. And Max Planck was somebody that would know what he was talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. And, you know, let's kind of go in the other direction, if you will. Last time you were on the program, Basically, you mentioned that about 120,000 years ago in the fossil record, Cro-Magnon man appears basically overnight. These guys pop up. And we connected this with the ancient Sumerian scriptures and mentioned the Anunnaki. From what we know, this was an off-world race of beings who came from Nibiru, and that these guys were responsible for genetically engineer hominoids and themselves to create the human being. According to the Sumerians, this happened around 200,000 years ago, something like that.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, let's begin to talk a little bit about the potential reasons for this. We really didn't get into detail about this last time. I mean, do you know at this point, why did they came here? How long did they stay, and what happened to them?
Well, we can only go pretty much with the research of Zechariah Sitchin based on the writings that are left behind in the Sumerian clay tablets. Now, Sumerians are considered the first great culture. Everyone acknowledges they appear out of nowhere. They're very highly sophisticated. They develop 100 of the firsts that we consider a part of a high society, the first writing, the first music, the first roads, the first blocked-off cities, the first trade, long-term trade, first ocean-going ships. I mean, they did remarkable things, and they came out of nowhere to do this. We're not taught much about the Sumerians. The only thing we're taught about, really, about them, and I would venture to say that most of your listeners, all you know about the Sumerians is that they invented writing, cuneiform, and that's
right.
It. It's all you're really taught.
Yeah.
You're not taught, I wasn't taught, nobody's taught, that these people exploded on the earth scene with this very high culture, and that the Egyptians and the Romans and the Greeks came down from them and picked up what they had from them. But the reason science doesn't deal with them is like everything else. It's an embarrassment to try to explain. If it's all about Darwinian progression, how do you go from people living in caves in the mountains, in the Zagros Mountains, to this incredible civilization flourishing down in the Tigris-Euphrates plain of modern-day Iraq? How could that have happened? In Darwinian terms, it couldn't, so they just don't talk about it. And they talk about writing because writing is so important, and they give the Sumerians credit for that, and that's pretty much it. In those writings, which are on clay tablets that have been turned into stone, they've been baked into stone, and you know the old, in ancient times, the catchphrase for something that was absolutely reliable was written in stone. This is written in stone.
Right.
That's why, because if the Sumerians said it, it was the way things were, as far as they were concerned. And what those stone tablets say, and understand, they're interpreted different ways. The mainstream interprets them to sound like it's supporting their position, so that what they say that doesn't make sense in real world terms, they just call it myth. They just say that the Sumerians were making it up as myth. But what Sitchin says is, what would they have myth for if they're the first culture? They're writing their history as they understand it, or their reality as they understand it. They're not creating myths. They're writing the way they understand it, and the way they say it was being told to them was that human beings, the Adamu, A-D-A-M-U, were created 200,000 years ago, that the Anunnaki, the people of the planet Nibiru that's in our solar system but comes in a very long elliptical orbit of 3,600 years, the people on that planet, the Anunnaki, came to Earth and lived here for many, about maybe as much as 600,000 years ago, certainly no less than 300,000 years ago, and lived for quite some time gathering gold, but gathering it easily, because all they had to do was put placers in rivers. But when they cleaned out all the easy gold, and the reason they needed gold for Nibiru, by the way, again according to them, is that they had their atmosphere and their rise to a high technology, same thing we're doing to our atmosphere, in fact. They had damaged their atmosphere of their planet, and they needed to repair it. And they had discovered that gold ground up to the consistency of talcum powder and blown up into their upper atmosphere would act as both a reflector of dangerous cosmic rays, and as an insulator, and for them probably it was more of a need for insulation. But in any case, this is what they say. They needed gold to repair their atmosphere. They have a planet that's three times basically the size of Earth, so it's a big planet, and it would need a lot of gold. So they recovered what they could recover by placer mining in rivers and things where gold just would sweep along, and it would just come out in a tray, and it was very easy to recover. And then, by then, they had found the mother lode of gold on Earth, which is southern Africa, and still is to this day. And so they needed to mine it now. And they did not want to do the heavy, hard work of mining, so they needed a slave to do that work. So they decided to create one, and it was a serious thing for them to do. There was a great debate about the morality of doing this, creating a whole new sentient being that was going to have to be dealt with once they were created. And the vote was close, but the vote came down in favor of making the slave, and so they did. And the slave was the Atomu, and that was us. So they took as a model to make their slave more physically adapted to the planet than they were. They took what they called a creature of Earth, which I say obviously that means a hominoid. Mm. That would be, in my guess, the Alma type from Russia, which I believe are probably Neanderthals. Anyway, they took some of them, I would say in the range of 5 to 10% maybe, and then the rest of the new creature would be them, would be like the Anunnaki. We shall make the Atomu in our own image, after our own likeness. That very quote comes from a Sumerian tablet, and we hear, as we hear several others, by the way, in Genesis, but we hear that quote coming down word for word 2,000 years later, written in Genesis. So that's apparently what they did according to the Sumerian tablets as Zechariah Sitchin has interpreted them.
You know, this is also, I mean, supported today actually in the mainstream in one way. If we do look at it, not the mythology, of course, behind this, but what we talked about before, the fact that about 200,000 years ago, I remember an article on CNN, for instance, that actually it was called "Humans Nearly Wiped Out 70,000 Years Ago." Study says,
right,
and this was actually they were talking about. Studies using mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down through mothers, have traced modern right. humans to a single mitochondrial Eve who lived in Africa about 200,000 years ago. And they talked about that a small group of humans back then actually, went down to the southern parts of Africa. And they don't kind of spin it in why there were, you know, a small portion of humans around at that point. But I mean, this basically you could interpret this information in two ways, and if we interpret it the way you've presented to us right now, this is actually corroborating evidence for this, and this is what the Genographic Project is doing right now. I don't know if you've heard about them at all, but they trace everything back to this mitochondrial Eve, as they call it.
Right. Well, here's something that's even more interesting. They had a book, I think, called The Seven Daughters of Eve, where they all of us seem to come from seven different, slightly different genetic pools that go back those 200,000 years. And I think the book is called The Seven Daughters of Eve. Get this. In the Sumerian tablets, which Sitchin wrote about, by the way, Sitchin wrote all this stuff in 1976. This is his first book, 1976, called The Twelfth Planet. He wrote all this. This is well before 86, 10 years later, when the mitochondrial Eve theory came out, when the mitochondrial DNA showed that the first human as we are today came into existence about 200,000 years ago. Well, that's when Sitchin was writing that we came into existence and that the Atomu were being created at about 200,000 years ago. So you're right, it was an amazing corroboration of what in 1976 sounded like just an absurd claim. And yet 10 years later, biology proves that in fact it wasn't absurd at all. It was right on the money. But also, relative to the Seven Daughters of Eve, what Sitchin says and what the tablets say is that there was a lot of experimenting to try to get the final copy, and a lot of mistakes were made because genetic engineering on that scale is difficult. I mean, it's just, you know, the gene, the genome itself is huge. It's 3 billion base pairs. The number of genes, 20, 30,000 genes. What do you have to do? How do you have to manipulate to make these two things that, that shouldn't be able to procreate, the hominoids with their 48 chromosomes and the Anunnaki with their 46. We know that because we have 46. We're the only primate, higher primate with 46. All the others have 48. So they had to do, a lot of manipulating to make that happen. In the end, they produced 7 females and 7 males that were correct, and they let them breed, and it all spun off from them. Those original 7 females and those original 7 males. And then, again, according to Sitchin in 76, and then you have this, these geneticists showing that it comes down to about 7 different main families, genetic families. So there is another incredible corroboration of what in 1976 sounded like absolutely insane conjecture on the part of Sitchin.
And, you know, the Bible has this account of the Nephilim coming down and actually breeding with women. But what do you think there is a connection between these two theories? Because in a way we could say that, okay, maybe the Anunnaki came at first, you know, and actually created the human race and kind of let them loose on the planet, if you will. But what the Bible is talking about is sounds more like someone actually is coming in and then afterwards is kind of, reproducing with the women of the earth at that point. Do you think these two...
Well, that's exactly what happened. Probably the Nephilim were the Anunnaki. What happened was, in terms of how many Anunnaki were on the earth, it seems, according to Sitchin, there were only a maximum of about 600. Now, that's really not that many, but whatever members of those 600, and there were males and females among the Anunnaki, but there were many, apparently more males than there were females to go around. So this is a hardship, you know, assignment to come to Earth. That's a hardship assignment. That's not necessarily something you want to do. That would be the equivalent of today's, the people who go out and try to, bring the religion to isolated primitive tribes or something like that. It was a hard thing to do. So they wanted comforts, and one of the things that they said in the tablets is they wanted to create a slave to do their work, but also to give the gods their ease. That's another quote, to give the gods their ease, meaning to make life good for them, to cook, to clean, and mostly to have sex with them. So they made them in their own image so they could use them as slaves and servants. So once they had the slave force online, they continued to let them propagate. They taught, they made them physically able to propagate themselves and to make more of themselves. And as they did that, they chose from all that they saw those which were fair, meaning they took the ones they wanted for themselves. And that terminology comes out in Genesis, but that is, according to Sitchin and the Sumerian tablets, that's the way it unfolded over time.
Indeed. And, you know, regarding also creators, if you will, from another world, I know that you very prominently lean on Sitchin's work on the Sumerian records to support this theory, but I think we also need to mention that there are other stories, of course, from around the world that has a very similar mythology, and some of those... has to do with that someone coming from the outside and giving man civilization, writing, what have you. The Hopi talks about the Kachina, the Incas has Viracocha, who was the creator of the civilization. The Mayans have Itzamna, an upper god, a creator deity, who was said to be residing in the sky. We have the Vedic texts, similar records of God descending down and mating with humans. So, I mean, this isn't just, limited to the Sumerians, right?
No, it's absolutely not. It's all over the place. There's something like, I think somebody once quoted that there were about 100 to 150 creation stories that all echoed a god or gods coming down to give the locals knowledge of how to live better in their place. And it goes, from simple things like which flowers are medicinal, which plants are medicinal, what you can take to help yourself, what's healthy for you, what's bad for you, what to stay away from. Because it's hard to imagine how primitive cultures would have figured out the process of creating, say, bread out of wheat. You know, how would somebody figure out to look at this grass and figure this can be made into a loaf? Who is going to do that? How's the first one going to think about it and make it happen? It isn't going to happen. Somebody's got to teach you how to do these fundamental things to live on this planet. And everybody, every culture passes down that it was taught to them. So it's pretty clear that that's what, I mean, we have a saying here, where there's that much smoke, there has to be some fire. And where there's that much, you know, anecdotal evidence, there has to be some truth. But science won't accept it because they have taken a position that none of that happened. And so as long as the authority position is that it never happened, you can't have UFOs acknowledged, you can't have aliens acknowledged, you can't have aliens in history acknowledged.
Right.
You can't have anything other than what the mainstream allows. And in our time and place, the mainstream allows none of that. So that's why people like you and me and the people who are listening to your show, we have knowledge that is special and kept away from the average person who doesn't make an effort to acquire the knowledge, but it's not knowledge that scientists or the mainstream government or, you know, it's not anything they don't know, but it's something they don't want the mass of us to know. So it becomes our job, just as it always has been the job of iconoclasts through history, like Alfred Wegener that I told you about relative to plate tectonics, and, you know, there are many, many other examples of that. It's up to us to get the word out as best we can to our friends and those, you know, those we know or those who have open minds. There's a lot of people that don't want to know.
That's right.
Do not want to know this stuff. And
yeah.
I know you have friends that way too. When you try to talk to them about these kinds of subjects, they tune off. A switch just turns and they don't want to hear it.
That's right.
They're happy and comfortable with the lie. And most people are happy and comfortable with the lie because it doesn't make them have to think too hard, because that's what these realities that we're talking about mean. They mean a complete reassessment of everything we think we know, and most people just don't want to bother with that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I want to ask you a little bit also about the time frame here, if you will, because if we think about the official story as it goes right now, then we have this idea that about 6,000 years ago, civilization, as it were, kind of appeared. We talked about this, that we're told that this happened in Sumeria and Babylonia, and there are certainly other theories out there that suggest otherwise, of course, but writing art and other skills seems to pop up in this area and a few other areas actually at the same time. But there is about 194,000 years between when, you know, the Anunnaki made us, according
right.
to the Sumerian record, and then, you know, when civilizations begin to kind of pop up. So, I mean, there's a long time frame there when, you know, what the heck has been going on there? I mean, we could have, great civilizations that kind of rise and fall in the middle here. Any theories about this at all, Lloyd?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that Atlantis might be one of those advanced civilizations that rose and fell. But you're right, there is a lot of time. But now, keep in mind, the fact that the Anunnaki created the Atamu around 200,000 years ago does not mean that they were exactly us as we are today. I think that they were more like the Cro-Magnons. That was basically the Cro-Magnons. Us as we are today needed a little bit of tweaking, and I think that tweaking might have come either naturally at around 70,000 years ago and thereafter. That bottleneck was caused by a volcanic eruption in Indonesia. We were talking about the hobbits at a place called Toba Inlet. The Toba volcano, supposedly that was right at 70,000 years ago, and it was the last great sort of quasi-extinction event. A lot of animals did die out, large mammals in North America, and a number of other things happened. to take out a lot of creatures, and also it bottlenecked a lot of them, meaning it brought their numbers way down. So that may have happened. There are other arguments that we didn't become who or what we are till around 50,000 years ago, so there may have been some more genetic tinkering at that point. But if they were going to do it, the time to do it would be when we were reduced greatly in numbers, I would think, so it would make it easier for them to build us back up in a better way. If indeed that's what happened. But also, too, there's a program here in the States, and I'm sure it'll come to Sweden if it hasn't already. It's called Life Without Humans, or Earth Without Humans. I think it's Earth Without Humans.
I've seen that,
It's looking at what the Earth would be like if humans were just suddenly to be completely wiped out tomorrow. What would it be like? And it shows how long it takes for things to just fall apart. And really, in only about 1,000 years, there is not much sign of us at all. I mean, it's just amazing. You think all the skyscrapers in New York and all this, it's amazing how fast that stuff, relatively speaking, just disintegrates. The steel, the concrete, the roads, it all goes away. It's really an amazing documentary. If your listeners can keep an eye out for it, I think it's called Earth Without Humans, and it's about, you know, just what I said. It's really interesting. So that being the case, if just in a few thousand years there's just no trace, that then throws us into the territory of Michael Cremo in his book Forbidden Archaeology, because if you don't know about Michael Cremo, you really need to, because his book Forbidden Archaeology talks about what are called OOPARTs, which is OOPARTS, out of place artifacts, OOPARTs. And there's literally hundreds of them that go back literally millions of years.
Yeah.
Millions of years. Now, that's considerably more than 200,000, so anything leaving OOPARTs 2 or 3 million years ago is not a human being. It's something else on the planet, something else here that is of a very high sophistication, leaving, you know, gold chains and things like that that are found in coal seams. That it's just, so Earth has got, could easily have a history that we can't even begin to imagine of the number of high cultures that might have been here and have since faded away to nothing, leaving only very small parts of themselves that are occasionally found and create these great mysteries like you find in Michael Cremo's Forbidden Archaeology.
Indeed, Michael does incredible research, and we did a program with Michael as well, so check that out in our archives. Brilliant stuff. And, you know, I was also thinking about this idea of the many people talk about the worldwide cataclysms that might have occurred. This article from CNN who talked about this mitochondrial DNA mentioned that a small portion of humans were left in southern Africa. But they, again, another theory that kind of might connect with that idea is that this happened because of a large cataclysm. People are also, of course, talking about that an object did come in to our solar system. We can even supplant Nibiru on top of this, I guess, that this was an incoming object that was creating incredible havoc in our solar system. We had global cataclysms, a lot of humans died off, and consequently we had to kind of rebuild from there, and potentially even a great civilization at that point might have fallen. What do you think about an idea like that, Lloyd?
Are you talking about it 70,000 years or at another time?
I mean, many people talk that this might have happened in cyclical periods. So this is something that happens, you know, again and again in a way. But basically,
there's no doubt that there have been five major catastrophic events that have wiped out anywhere from 50 to 90% of all life. Those are well documented in the fossil record. There have been a dozen what are called minor. I don't know how you call a catastrophic event minor, but, you know, they're considered minor relative to the major, in which you lose anywhere from 10 to 50% of all life forms. That's happened quite a bit. Nobody denies that. And by the way, the last major one was 65 million years ago, the Cretaceous extinction that wiped out the dinosaurs. But so there are more minor catastrophes, one of which occurred at 70,000 years ago. But that one is very well documented as the Toba volcanic eruption, which is a what's it called, a super volcano. There's regular volcanoes like Mount St. Helens or Pinatubo, Mount Pinatubo, or anyone you want to talk about. And then there are super, there are about a half a dozen, no, maybe a dozen, I think it's more like a dozen, super volcano caldera around the Earth, one of which, the biggest one, is in Yellowstone National Park in America. And if that one were to go again, the way it has done in the past, that's it. We would be gone, and it would be a major catastrophe. The one at Toba Inlet was 70,000 years ago was bad enough. It wasn't as big or as bad as what the one at Yellowstone has the capacity to do, but still, it was pretty bad. Now, as far as a comet or a meteor or an asteroid coming in within 70,000 years, yes, those are all possibilities, and we could have had any number of not necessarily superior but different cultures on the planet that have just been wiped out, and you have to start again. But us, the way we are, the final product kind of that we're looking at today, I think that does not appear until around 50 to 70,000 years ago, somewhere in there. We are, and I don't know, you know, it's hard to know if we are the result of just confined inbreeding of that group that survived the Toba Inlet catastrophe, or if the Anunnaki came in and saw that our numbers were greatly reduced and said, oh, we have an opportunity now to upgrade the Atomu from what we originally created. Let's go ahead and make the upgrade now. And that might have been what happened. But I think you go from Cro-Magnon types to us, and there is a change and there is a difference. Cro-Magnons are very much like us, but they're not quite us. They're a little bigger, a little more robust, and it takes some fine-tuning to get it to us, and it does seem to have occurred in the 70,000 to 50,000 window, and something could have happened in there other than Toba Inlet at 70,000 years ago. Could have happened a little bit later, but I think the 70,000 would have been the right time to get started on that, and it just wouldn't have happened overnight. It would have taken time, especially if it was inbreeding in an isolated or a group of isolated populations, and so that would take as much as 10 or 20,000 years. So, you know, I think the time and the circumstances are there for it to have happened either way, whether genetic manipulation or just natural isolated breeding to create us as we are today.
Fascinating. I think this is a good place to begin to round things up here for the first segment. We're going to continue to talk more in our member section about human design, and I'm going to ask Lloyd about bad design, and we can look at some of the human properties, if you will, and compare them to other primates, and there's a very interesting story there. I'm going to ask Lloyd a little bit more about intelligence, savants, and kind of unlocking, if you will, the brain's true capacity, and also if there's any updates on the star child skull. So do join us in our member section. But before we do that, though, I want to ask you to give out your website addresses again. You have a few different ones out there, and also tell us more about your books and how people can get the copies that you have out there.
Okay. We do have copies of the Star Child Skull book. That's very easily available at Amazon.com or Amazon.com UK. For those of you that live in Europe, all you have to do is go to Amazon.com UK. Now, that is the paperback version of the book. That the only difference is the hardback, you have to go through Bellap Books to get that, which is bellapbooks.com, BellapBooks, Bellap Books, all one word, .com, and that'll get you to the hardback. And the difference is that of the 80 illustrations in it, 40 of them are in color, and of course it's a much nicer, more durable book, and you can get it signed. I'll sign those. I obviously can't sign the paperbacks coming from Amazon, but they're a little more expensive because they're hardbacks and you have to pay for shipping and all that. You make that choice, but the Star Child Skull is available, and the Star Child website is www.starchildproject.com, all one word, starchildproject.com. And if you don't know what that is, it is a real true bone skull that in every way and through every test seems to be a hybrid between a human and an alien, and we will talk about that in the other segment. My personal website is www.lloydpye.com, LLOYDPYE.com, LloydPye.com.
Brilliant. So that is belllabbooks.com, lloydpye.com, and starchildproject.com.
Okay, and I should also add again, we should repeat that the Everything You Know Is Wrong is not available there, but you can get it through the website, the email address that will be on the Red Ice Creations website.
That's right, definitely. Lloyd, thank you very much for this segment. Stay with us, and we'll talk more in our member section after this break.
Thank you, Henry.
Thank you, and thank you to you for listening, and thanks to Fredrik out in the control room. Tell your friends about Red Ice Creations, help spread the word, sign up, and join our member section. We'll talk more after this break.
Take away your state of mind. Take away interactive rhyme. Take away your suicide. You're not too full to swallow your pride.